And love isn't something you achieve, it's something you realize. It's what's left when everything else has been kind of cleared away. So I think the biggest challenge is realizing that when it comes to love, less is actually more.
Do you think in the next hour, maybe we can teach people how to be more loving and how to maybe have more love in their lives?
Yes, we definitely can.
Okay, well, that's the goal. I'm curious, yeah. Why did you write this particular book?
My journey as Humble the Poet is generally selfishly trying to pursue learnings and wisdoms and improve my life and then share my notes in a form that other people can digest. And in the world of love, I was, and I still am, you know, struggling to realize more love in my life. And it was becoming very apparent, especially with a lot of my relationships, that I was not receiving love and I wasn't serving love the way to its full potential. And it was something that we got really interested in. And it was pre-pandemic. I was already kind of taking notes and looking at it. And the deeper I went, the more you started to realize how much conditioning we've had from media, society, religion, culture, you know, heritage, as to what love is. And so often we spend so much time chasing these things that feel, look, and sound like love, but they're not. And so for me, it became really a devotion to figuring out the best ways to realize love, to improve the quality of my life and the life of those around me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the biggest obstacle to having love in your life?
I think people's understanding. Sorry, I just got to move something right here. But I think people's understanding of what love is. I think we've been conditioned to view love as a prize or a gift or a loan or something transactional, something that we earn, something that we have to deserve. And then that really informs the type of decisions we make on a daily basis in order to achieve this love. And love isn't something you achieve, it's something you realize. It's what's left when everything else has been kind of cleared away. So I think the biggest challenge is realizing that when it comes to love, less is actually more. And love is much more of an action, a verb, a service, than it is some thing that we have to chase and acquire.
Mm-hmm. And if the obstacle is that transactional attitude, if so many of us have that, how do we first identify that?
I think one of the important things that we can all do is, and fortunately, most of us do have some authentic realizations of love in our lives, whether it's with our families, whether it's with activities, whether it's with a piece of art. There are these genuine relationships that we have that have revealed love to us. If we use those as an anchor and start comparing everything else to those, I think that's the first step. You know, I always use the analogy of holding my baby niece for the first time and being flooded with love. You know, she didn't do anything for me to love her so much. We didn't have to build and establish a connection. Nothing was required. And what it was is that the purity of the love was always there. And we just hadn't done anything to, you know, kind of pollute it or cover it all up. And I think that's the important idea that people have to understand is that, you know, if our relationship with ourselves is struggling, then it's going to impact every other relationship we have. Whether it's the relationship with somebody romantically, whether it's with our family, whether it's with our coworkers, whether it's with the things we love, you know, the intangible, our passions, our obsessions. And from that standpoint, realizing that this can't be a transaction. You know, love is one of those things that the more you give, the more you reveal. So it is counterintuitive to a lot of the societies that we live in, because the societies we live in are based on building economies, and that transactional nature of things is kind of embedded in that. So it really is a little bit of a mental gymnastics practice to get ourselves out of that mindset to look at things a little bit different. It's like brushing your teeth with the opposite hand. You can do it, but it just feels a little bit weird, but there's a lot of benefit to doing that.
Mm-hmm. How does the block, how does the transactional piece manifest for you personally?
I think it makes you view love as a loan. You know, I gave it to you, I need to have it back. and you're keeping score and you're measuring. Mm-hmm. And these days, especially with social media, everything has a value to it now. How many people like your picture? How many people commented on your post? And what that does is that just makes people keep score. And I think the challenge with that is that people can't read minds. People aren't communicating. And what we should be doing is not giving it and hope it returns. Give it because we have it. And, you know, view ourselves as a source of love, not as love-thirsty individuals feeling completely depleted, trying to find a source for love.
Mm-hmm. How can we determine if we're kind of stuck in that loop? Is there a feeling or a way that affects people that you see that we could all be more aware of?
I think from a very basic level, just looking at the idea if you are either drained or energized, mm-hmm. you know, certain interactions we have with individuals completely drain us. Certain interactions we have with other individuals completely energize us. Same thing with activities. Same thing with ideas. And I think that's one of the really first ways to kind of look at this is, you know, do I feel like I'm being drained or do I feel like my cup is being full? And I think that's a really good note to pay attention to when it comes to creating pathways for love. So often we prioritize being likable. We prioritize being accepted. We prioritize fitting in over actually revealing and experiencing authentic love. And all that's actually doing is closing these pathways to love. So we're trading our ability to realize more love for these immediate gratification type feelings that, you know, are kind of embedded into us from our tribal days.
Mm-hmm. I'm just so curious, how do you deal with this? I mean, you are a musician, you are a public person. So much of the way that people know you is through this personality and things like social media. So how do you manage that?
I think for me, it's kind of recognizing it from both ends. So like if you can't be impacted by people's thoughts, not just their negative thoughts. So, you know, if I receive a lot of praise, that praise has to have the same level of value as the criticism. And I have to, you know, be honest with myself that, okay, you know, 100 people just said really nice things about me, but they don't know me. They have an obstructed view of who I am. Everyone has an obstructed view of who I am, even the people that know me the deepest. And giving value to that, you know, the reason we would give any value to that is it goes back to feeding our self-esteem, which is, you know, creating external, you know, creating value for ourselves from external sources. So the big thing that I try to practice is cultivating my self-respect, which is internal, which comes from keeping my promises to myself, you know, challenging myself regularly, and focusing on being a source of love, but also being a source of my self-value, understanding that these concepts of enoughness don't exist, and also understanding that as a creative, by default, I have to say something. And if you actually say something, there are going to be people that disagree with that. Mm. And that's really important. I'm not a generic minimalist product for everyone to consume. You know, some people will love everything that I create and other people will completely hate it. And, it took a lot of introspection, but also reflection and speaking to other people in the situation and being like, okay, you know, you're a public figure. That's very different than being famous. You know, being a celebrity is an art in itself, and that's not something you want to do. All the celebrities you know are operating on a lot of anxiety, constantly chasing this concept of being relevant. As well as the people who consume your work, they're not your fans. They are your readers. They are your listeners. They owe you nothing. You owe them nothing. This is, you know, there are people whose music you listen to, but don't follow them on Instagram and don't know what's happening in their life. You know, this is a service, you know, and I think the pandemic really taught us how important creativity was to kind of maintaining our balance and mental health. You know, whether it was people watching Tiger King on Netflix or listening to a podcast or, you know, listening to music while they're stuck in traffic. Art is such an essential service. So for me, I look at it as an obligation. I look at it as my job and look at it as important. And I don't require flowers for it. I don't require acknowledgement for it. I think the fact that I'm on this journey is enough reward itself for me.
Mm-hmm. And we're touching on a theme of the book, which is an addiction to approval, I think. What do you think is going on with addiction to approval, and how can we spot it?
I think a lot of this goes back to our childhoods. And the thing was, when you're younger, with a developing brain, we can only think of the world in terms of duality, you know, right, wrong, this, that, good, bad, you know. And as adults, we understand life is way more complex. You know, it isn't just simply this or that. But we make a lot of choices and decisions based off that dualistic view when we're younger, and we don't really update our software and update those kind of rules. So whatever we had to do to survive our childhood, and I know survive is a strong word, but whatever we have to do to navigate it kind of sticks with us as in adulthood if we don't become self-aware and revisit it. So I think, you know, the interesting thing is, like, as children, you know, we're often raised by, you know, if most likely being raised by your parents, but they're flawed individuals. And we don't understand as children that they can come home from a hard day at work, be in a bad mood that has nothing to do with us. You know, we'll internalize that and think it's our fault. And then we'll try to do whatever we can to gain favor, you know, gain that reward system. And it's that unanticipated reward that we become addicted to. You know, it's a very common idea actually being used. That's what's being used in gambling. You know, when you pull that lever in the slot machine, you don't know when you're going to win. And that unanticipated reward becomes an addiction in itself. That's why people stay in abusive relationships, because when it's bad, it's bad. But when it's good, it's so unanticipated and really good. Same thing with social media. You flick your thumb through all the posts and it just makes you feel like crap, comparing yourself to other people, seeing all this sad news. And all of a sudden, oh, look, a cute puppy. Okay, that made it worth it. You know, even if that's a 5-second clip within an hour of scrolling. So this addiction to approval, I think a lot of it comes from the idea that we don't know when it's going to come. We don't know when we're going to get that little shot of dopamine. And I think it's just recognizing, you know, and really prioritizing some long-term rewards over short-term rewards. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a society where, you know, I don't want to use the word vice, but every pursuit of pleasure is getting easier and easier and easier. You know, I can press a couple buttons on my app and liquor will show up. Press a couple buttons on your computer and you can have the sexy naked people. You know, weed delivery, whatever it may be that provides pleasure for people, is becoming so easy. And I think the easier these vices become, the more they become weaponized against us. You know, it's not like you gotta climb to the top of the Hollywood Hills to get a drink, you know. And I think, you know, it's really skewing things, because now pleasure is less about feeling good and more about not feeling bad. And I think we're constantly in that pursuit of not feeling bad, keeping ourselves back to zero. And pleasure is no longer just feeling good. It's really medication from a lack of peace in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you kind of touched on pornography. What do you think the relationship is between pornography and people's desire for love?
You know, I think a lot of us were raised through media with this idea of unconditional love, mm-hmm. you know, that we somehow, someone's supposed to give us unconditional love. And not only are they supposed to give us unconditional love, that we know what unconditional love looks like, you know. And I think a lot about this. I was talking to a friend about this in terms of our parents. You know, our parents' version of love isn't complimenting us and saying they're proud of us. It's cutting up a plate of fruit as soon as we walk in the door. You know, it's you know, they express their love in different ways. But if we grew up watching Full House and wanting that Danny Tanner love, you know, we don't get it. So then we're on this constant pursuit of it. And I think that's why a lot of people chase fame. And I think what porn does in a lot of contexts is it creates this opportunity where you find somebody who's, you know, they're visually stunning and they're completely there for you. You know, they're always in the mood. They're only here to please you. Everything they're doing is for you specifically. And it creates this hyper normal, this super normal that isn't, you know, really in line with what life is. You know, those are real people. If you were in a real relationship with those real people, they're gonna have good days and not so good days. And you don't just get to press next and have a whole different experience. And you know, there's something there when you have too many options. There's something there when it comes too easy. I think that probably does a disservice for us when it comes to our real life relationships and intimacy, and understanding of what it means to coexist with real human beings.
Yeah, it sounds like a hyperstimulus, like a junk food kind of thing. And then at the same time, it's so available, and yet it's people put it in a mental space that's kind of like something that we really desperately want and need.
Yeah, completely. And I think, you know, I think the junk food is probably the best way. You know, even calling it fast food. You know, I'm not here to insult people in the adult film industry. But it's fast food. It's quick, it's easy, it's convenient, it's cheap. You know, and when I mean cheap, I mean the cost of entry isn't very high in comparison to if you actually want to have a sexual experience in real life. You know, and that's going to require you to get up, take a shower, get out of your house, be social, you know, connect with somebody, you know, make them feel safe, create an environment where you can actually have sex with somebody. Where here is just a couple clicks on your computer, and it's the same thing. You know, and it's not just porn, as I said. Like social media gives us this fast food version of connection. Again, it's not a real connection; it's just a fast food version of it. The same way fast food gives us a version of food that's very delicious, very quick, cheap, and convenient, but it's not very nutritious. You can't do it forever. And you see the same thing when it comes to pornography, or social media. It's when you have these hyperstimulants and your reward systems are just shooting off, then it raises our anxiety. And you know, now our anxiety is us becoming dopamine addicts, and we just haven't had a dopamine fix for 5 seconds. We got to go find it somewhere. Where peace is going to come from just being able to literally do nothing, just sit there and do absolutely nothing. No stimulants, no screens. None of that. And it's our biology is definitely not designed to be dealing with the stimulants that we have in this modern society.
You also talked about having too many options. I wonder, what do you think about love in the context of, there's this trend toward polyamory or open relationships. Do you feel like their love is more divided when you have something going like that, or how do you see it?
Well, in the book, I do explore the concept of compersion and mudita, which is this idea that if you love someone, their joy brings your joy. So even if you're in an intimate relationship with somebody and they want to be intimate with somebody else, if that brings them joy, you authentically find happiness for that. So, you know, I think, you know, with, you know, you can't make a blanket statement about any type of lifestyle. I think it's really interesting and cool that something like polyamory exists, because for it to function would require intense levels of communication and vulnerability. And I've had, you know, I have a friend who Aubrey Marcus, who's very popular, known for his polyamorous relationships, and it was very public. And the conversations I would have with him was like, he was like, "Hey, like, I'm also hanging out with the men who are sleeping with my women, you know, like I am, this is an ego melting activity for me. You know, this isn't simply about having four girlfriends. I'm also spending time with the other men." And, you know, what that does to your, you know, the quote unquote fragile male ego. And he goes, "That's what the spiritual journey is for me." But at the end of the day, you know, he left it all, found somebody else and got married, you know? So, and I've had a conversation with him about it, especially once it happened. When he made that switch, and he's like, "Look," he felt it was a very important theme of his life. I am not personally, and this is anecdotally and non-scientific, I am not aware of any long-term couples who are still in polyamory. I personally am not. You know, maybe they have a commune somewhere that I'm not aware of, but I've met quite a few people trying to practice it. I think if enough time goes by, I haven't seen much long-term success with it. But I do see value in challenging traditions, going off script, in a world of a lot of communication and mutual respect.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Aubrey too. I just heard his ex-fiance, Whitney, on another podcast, and she was talking about how after they split, she went right into a very steady monogamous relationship with a nice man, and that that's been great for her. So it seems there's this, like you said, there's these things that don't seem to last for people.
Yeah, and as I said, anecdotally, I don't want to make a, you know, I don't want to be like, well, I don't know anybody who hasn't succeeded in polyamory, so it must not exist. Like, I don't want to say that either. As I said, like, I don't know everybody on the planet, and there could be people in their 80s right now living wonderfully beautiful polyamorous relationships. But I think, you know, there's something interesting there. And I think it's also, you know, it could also be a response to us losing our villages. You know, I think the village served as the multiple relationships that we needed, and then we got compartmentalized, where your one partner has to be your sexual partner, your co-parent, your co-business owner, the person you pay taxes with, the person that you're building a home with, like, you know, it's just everything, your best friend, all of this. And that's a fairly new concept as well, you know, that romantic concept. Even romance and marriage is a very pretty new concept in terms of human history. Marriage used to be very transactional, to consolidate land and power. So I kind of view it as like we're figuring it out, and you know, recognizing that every human being is unique, responding to different stimuli. So you know, to each their own, and try your best doing it. And you know, I do hope to stumble upon a community of 70 and 80 year old polyamorous people living their best life.
You mentioned romantic marriages as a new thing. And mm-hmm. in your book, you also wrote a little bit about arranged marriages and some even in your mm-hmm. own family. And it seemed to be a mostly positive thing. So I wonder, have you considered an arranged marriage?
I've definitely not considered an arranged marriage. I think for me, my parents had an arranged marriage. So like my life exists because of an arranged marriage. So the last thing I'm going to do is knock it. And I don't see a lot of difference between, you know, two people getting married based off of, you know, a set of criteria, you know, and compared to somebody who subconsciously gives themselves a deadline to find a husband or a wife. I got to get married before I'm 30. It's still kind of this idea of forcing love. And I do believe love can form. And I've seen a gang of different types of arranged marriages where, you know, some are complete partnerships and they're working at it. And, you know, there's not an ounce of romance or intimacy in the relationship other than what you see it is. And other ones, they look like they've been dating since they were in high school. And, you know, they really both leaned into it heavily. And I do think arranged marriages, you know, especially like probably the way it's morphing now, where your parents are more, they're more matchmakers than they are commanded. You will marry them. And, you know, we planned this since you were three. You know, it's not that no more. Now it's more like, hey, I have, you know, I have a list of prospects, and these people I feel like fit the bill. And I think what they'll do in those contexts is ask some of the questions that people don't ask when they date. Finances, family health history, all of that. I think those things really matter, and those aren't the kind of things you really ask anybody. And there is something to be said about modern dating, where the first couple of times everyone's putting the best foot forward, trying to make a good impression, and then maybe later on you start to ask yourself, okay, I've won this person over, but are they right for me? And then I think that creates a lot of conflict in dating. So I think, you know, my conclusion in it is I can't say one is better than the other. You know, but I do understand that all relationships, romantic, non-romantic, work relationships, family, business, everything, when your priorities are in alignment, you're more likely to be successful.
Yeah. And you have your parents as people who are hopefully going to be very much aligned with you. And then to find someone like that, it sounds in some ways, you know, hopeful, exciting. And I used to be in the U.S. Navy, and so I'd come across people from a lot of different cultures, and trained with guys who were Saudi, had a roommate who was Indian, and they were going through this sort of process where their parents were matchmaking for them, and they were very excited about it. They would look forward to going home and meeting nice women who their parents had kind of picked out, and they were looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think the other issue too is, I think it raises a lot of questions, especially here in North America, is how well do your parents even know you, right? And I think at the end of the day too, they're looking at resumes. They really are looking at, it's really looking at resumes. Like, who is this person? What do they do? Who is their family? Like, that's kind of where it starts and stops. So they're not really looking, at attachment styles, personality styles, all of these different things that kind of come into play. And again, like, is that any different than somebody judging me based off my horoscope? So it's like, I see versions of it, and I think, the goal of including it in the book was to kind of challenge this idea that it's some draconian form of oppression. I think it's a viable option, especially in a culture where people are already more obsessed with their weddings than their actual marriage.
And Humble, we've been talking about sort of, forget the phrase you use, but something like having more of a credibility with yourself that kind of can help you to get away from this addiction to approval and things like that. I wonder, do you have practices that you use? I mean, do you do cold showers, or do you take a day off from social media, or what do you do to kind of build that credibility with yourself?
Yeah, so I think the way I framed it was just like self-respect over self-esteem. And I think a lot of the things that we search for from other people, providing it for ourselves. So doing the hard work, definitely, so for me, and I remember hearing this from Tom Bilyeu, who's a successful entrepreneur, and he would always say, waking up the moment my alarm rings, having a cold shower, and getting to the gym within the first hour of being awake, all make me feel better about myself than when I made $400 million. And I think there was a, the internal versus the external. So I think honoring your commitments, I think that a lot of self-awareness around our commitments is that we receive dopamine from setting a goal. And then when it's time to act on that goal, it's not there, we're in the same city, and a lot of people get dopamine from making a plan, like, oh, we should meet up for coffee, and the dopamine releases, and then the follow through just feels like, ah, like every highway's packed. This is just gonna suck. And I think becoming aware of that, which is you're not doing this for the dopamine, you're doing this because you said you were going to do it, and honoring that is what builds respect. And yeah, for me, it's also just leaning into as many challenges as possible. So, I mean, I'm part of the Ice Boys. So, after going to Poland and training with Wim Hof, taking cold showers every day. But again, once you get used to that, you have to increase the challenge. Waking up earlier, honoring all my commitments. If I, my words need to match my actions as much as possible. When they can't, I have to completely clearly communicate and take ownership. Speaking the truth as much as humanly possible. That's been a really big one for me. As I've been out here experiencing people who don't. In the form of fitness, recognizing that, okay, maybe I can't get myself down to the gym every day, so then I hired a trainer. So that's like instant accountability, but just showing up and feeling good because I've done that. Setting intentions instead of goals. So it used to be like, oh, when I was writing this book, oh, I need to write 1,000 words a day. And then I changed that to, no, I just need to have uninterrupted writing every single day for an hour, whether I write 1 word or 1,000, as long as that 1 hour went by and it didn't do anything else. And watching that activate flow for me, just creating those conditions, owning my limitations. It's like healthy eating starts at the grocery store. It doesn't start by having discipline in the kitchen, and using that for everything. What other things should I be avoiding, and how do I do that? So, for me, up until this book release, I had no social media on my phone, and it was fantastic. Now for the next couple of months, I have to dive headfirst into that world and participate. But I'm looking forward to getting rid of it again. And yeah, so just picking things that are challenging. And in the book, I mentioned my friend Steve Weatherford, who's a retired NFL player, and he just said, honor your commitments, not your feelings. You said you're going to do something, just do it because you said you're going to do it. the end. And I think there's a lot of value and self-respect in that. And you have less of a need for external validation when you strengthen your own sense of self.
Hearing you say this takes me back to an interview that you and I did back in 2019. And one of the things you said that I never forgot was you said, clarity is kindness. And I've repeated that to so many friends and things as we've talked about, you know, relationships, friendships, commitments, particularly in Los Angeles. It's all there in what you're saying, I think, whether it's with yourself or with others.
Yeah, and I think especially here, because it's like, you know, I've been jumping back and forth between here and New York, and somebody recently put it really well. He said, New York people are kind but not nice. LA people are nice but not kind. And the example was, if you were pushing a stroller down the stairs in New York, someone would help you put your stroller down and then walk away. You know, and over here, it's like everybody wants to be nice, but they're not actually being kind to you. Like, they'll say yes when they mean no. And so even through this journey of just marketing this book and reaching out to people, I was mentally prepared for a lot of no's, but not, you know, in LA, no sounds like yes. And that's been a challenge for me to kind of reintegrate myself with, because it's been a couple of years since I spent time here. So my bullshit meter needs to get recalibrated.
So we've been talking about a lot of blocks to love, and now maybe we could switch gears a little bit. What do you think it looks like when someone's really experiencing love?
So one of the definitions of love that I have in the book is that, you know, love is what exists when all other emotions are gone. And I think it creates a feeling of presence. It creates a feeling of energy, and it creates a feeling of peace. And, you know, a feeling of certainty and safety that we all kind of crave. And it's not like a spike of it, you know. I think that's the big difference. It's not just spike of dopamine. And I think a lot of us experience that with some of our favorite activities. A lot of us experience that being around some of our favorite people. So for me, I always lean back to those moments. And I, you know, even going back to my relationships with people that I love the deepest, and seeing how, oh, okay, I love my mom, but I know her flaws, and none of her flaws are what makes her a normal human being. None of those disqualify her from my love, and none of that impacts my ability to have love or create a pathway of love with her. So I think for me, that's kind of where the feelings is. It's almost a feeling of not wanting. You know, it's instead of the feeling of having everything, it's that feeling of not wanting. And I also describe it in the book as the feeling of being everything and nothing at the same time.
It sounds like a Zen meditation kind of thing. Is it that hard to put your finger on?
I don't know if it's really putting your finger on. I think it's kind of like, I'm just trying to think. It's kind of like, you know, you struggle with anxiety and you take some CBD, right? And then you forget, and then the day goes by and you're like, did the CBD work? And it's like, well, it's an absence. Like, what's the absence of anxiety feel like? You know, it's baseline. Like, that's what you are. So you don't notice an absence of something. You know, you just go through your day and the anxiety is just not poking at you for that day. So I look at it from that context. When I think of love, it's that feeling of flow. It's that feeling of, you know, you're not concerned with time. You're not concerned with a lot of different things. And I think that stillness and that quietness within you, I don't think it's something that you pay attention to, because I think even paying attention to it in itself is kind of like rippling the pond. So I don't want to say it's abstract. I want to say something that everybody listening has already felt, and they chase already. It's just that we have all these not so reasonable families that give it to us in these short bursts, and it's almost like that. As I said, the nothingness is the everything. And I guess in some capacities, I can see how that gets a little bit Zen, or abstract, or, you know, sounds like an ayahuasca trip. But I think at the same time, I think it's something that everyone has felt. They felt it on a walk through the park. They felt it you know, cuddling with their puppy. They felt it in these different ways where it's just, you know, nothing else matters. I'm not thinking about what I need. I'm not in a state of scarcity. I'm not in a state of fear. You know, it's peace. And, you know, peace is what we need to prioritize over pleasure.
Mm-hmm. So if it's this stillness kind of thing, then what is the feeling that we often label as love? What's that Hollywood butterflies in the stomach? What is that feeling?
That's your fight or flight system's warning you to get the fuck away from that person. I think a lot of those are triggers. Those are actual triggers. You know, we are attracted to what's familiar. We lean into what's familiar, not what's healthy. If you grew up around parents who were human beings, by default, that means they had their flaws. And they were your first definition of love. And you're going to lean into that very heavily without even realizing it if you're not practicing self-awareness. So those butterflies in your stomach. There's actually a study I cited in the book, I think it was about 1,100 couples who had been together for more than a decade, and less than 8% ever reported any butterflies in the stomach, you know, when they met or ever. And I think, again, it's an idea being sold to us. And most of the couples that we're going to see in modern media are couples who are eventful. You know, that's the best way to put it. Healthy couples are not eventful. Healthy couples are existing in a state of peace, but they wouldn't make for great TV. So instead, what we're seeing is we're seeing people with anxious attachment styles meet people with avoidant attachment styles, and you're watching the tug of war of them going back and forth, and then you start to think that that's what it should be for you. But really, I think it really should be peace. It's kind of like when you have that epiphany. You realize something, you put two and two together, you make a connection from one part of your life to another. There's just this kind of moment of like, you know what I mean? I think that's what love was going to end up feeling like, especially when you meet a person. Like, oh, this fits. And again, it's not going to be a perpetual fit and this is going to be perfect, because if you start a life with that person, now you have logistics and bills and time and energy and everything. And that's why in the book I say love is fuel, not glue. Love doesn't keep people together. Love gives us the energy to work at it. And your love for someone should be your motivation for trying to make it work, not your assumption that, oh, because I love them, it will just work, you know? And so that modern, again, dopamine shot, you know, that we get, again, it's an excitement that's being sold to us for our entertainment and consumption.
Mm-hmm. So if it's this sort of gentle feeling, it would seem you wouldn't want to hold on to it too tight. How do you know how much focus to give the love in your relationship, or when maybe you're putting too much focus on your relationship or that feeling of love?
I don't know if you can give something too much focus. I think if we look at anybody in the world who's known for anything, like a LeBron James, for example, they've devoted their life to one thing and they do it extremely well. And that's how you become great at something. So devoting yourself to your relationships, I think, is extremely important if that's your priority. And there's endless ways to do that. But probably the most important way to do it is by focusing on your relationship with yourself. You know, I have been in situations where people were showering me with love and attention and service, but I wasn't in a place to receive it. You know, my bucket was turned upside down, so it could rain on me all day and it wouldn't have mattered. And the only way I'm ever going to receive love or reveal more love in my life is to learn, you know, how to turn that bucket upside down and let it face upwards. So improving your relationship with yourself is probably the best thing you can do to improve your relationships with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the sports analogy with LeBron James. For you as a musician, how do you incorporate love in your work, or do you?
Craft, you know, at the end of the day, we're all craftsmen. We're all, you know, we are doing something repeatedly over and over and over and over again. And when you share it with the public who doesn't practice that same craft, you know, they view it as magic. And so for me, I think the biggest thing that I've been doing lately is honoring what parts of this really energize me. So, you know, marketing a book isn't my favorite part of this journey. It's an essential part because the book's got to sell for them to put me in a position to write another one. But, you know, writing, researching, learning, these things just completely energize me. And the more I do it, the better I get at it. You know, in my last book, I referenced ping pong as my procrastination activity. And I got really good at ping pong just from procrastinating by playing it. And so for me in this world, it's really focusing and honoring that. So, you know, I write a lot of music. I'm not currently advertising or promoting or releasing any music, but I write music every day because it energizes me. It gets me excited. It gets me so excited. I never feel drained, and I never have to drag myself to the studio to do it. It's almost my happy place. So I think honoring that, chasing fun, I think is really, really, really important. Because that's where a lot of love lives. And you know, when people say love is a game, the real purpose of a game isn't to win, it's to keep everybody wanting to play.
So when we talk about love and sort of playing this game, often what's seen as the end or the goalpost is marriage. What role do you think marriage has in love? Is it an ultimate expression, or is it a bond? Does it amplify love? How do you see marriage playing with love?
So I do think, you know, in Western society, you know, we view everything kind of linear. There's a beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, marriage being kind of this climactic moment when really you're beginning a whole journey. You know, I think it's the only, you know, a wedding is probably the only beginning moment in someone's life where you throw a big party. You know, when you graduate, you don't throw a party for starting high school or starting college. You know, you throw a party for graduating high school, graduating college. And it's kind of like we have it in reverse where it's like, I'm going to get married, so I have to throw this big lavish party. And then 10 years into my marriage, I'll have like a quiet dinner to celebrate my anniversary. When actually the 10 years of being married is the actual accomplishment worthy of the party. So I think, you know, there's been a massive economy created around weddings and marriage. And I think both starting them and ending them. And I think that's really had an impact on kind of the institution of what it is. I think the importance of it comes in the fact that it's a commitment that has real repercussions if you renege on those commitments. You know, you're literally signing paperwork to be with somebody, and there'll be financial consequences at the bare minimum for breaking that. And I think that helped earlier to kind of reveal what a real deal breaker is in a marriage. And everything else should become a negotiation, a talk, a conversation, labor. As I said, I think as the economies around this stuff grew, you know, the trap doors to get out of a marriage have become wider and more accessible because there's money in it for someone for you to get divorced. So it's easier to get married, it's easier to get divorced. And I think that's kind of challenged the institution of it. And it does require a level of update. I think it would be very interesting if it was illegal to be married until you were 30. I think it'd be very interesting to see how life would be. You know, we have age limits for smoking, drinking, and, you know, voting. But we don't have it for marriage, which is often can be cited as, you know, some of the biggest financial decisions people will ever make in their life. You know, and it's also, I believe if you look at, and I think 50 Cent talked about this, but if you look at some of the wealthiest people on Forbes, their biggest financial hits have been divorces. So, you know, there's real life consequences. I've only been through breakups. I can't imagine going through a breakup plus going through the financial struggles of finalizing that breakup. So that's heartbreak plus, you know, getting robbed at the bank. So I think, you know, the original concept of marriage was transactional, two families consolidating their wealth. You know, it almost had this financial relationship to it from the beginning. And then somewhere along the lines, this idea of I have to like the person I marry came in, and the romance around it. There's these emotional kind of anchors to the idea, in my opinion, are really associated with the economy built around it. You know, they really want to sell you that idea the same way they want to sell you 2 months' salary to buy a diamond ring, you know, put on somebody's finger. So I, you know, I can see beyond that. I think it's important. The numbers aren't in its favor in terms of the success rate of marriage as of late. But as an entrepreneur, as a dream chaser, you know, and as somebody who's accomplished something that few people have been able to accomplish, and the odds were against my favor, I can only say the same thing should be the same for marriage. You know, even if 50% of all marriages fail, there's still 50% that don't. Or maybe some of those are failing from the inside out, but maybe there's 5% that are real. And I think if you find something real and you create something beautiful, I think there's something amazing there. In addition to the importance of having that structure when raising children, you know, if you want to raise human beings, a healthy family structure, it was definitely a plus. So I see the value of marriage for that as well.
Mm-hmm. And you start the book with a story of yourself and being engaged and then breaking that off. What was that like for you?
It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. You know, and that was the thing, like, you know, starting this book was trying to meet, was my journey to improve myself in that relationship. And then the deeper I went into the book, the more I realized that that wasn't the relationship I should have been in. And I was, you know, my body knew, you know, and, but, you know, there's pressure, there's history, there's family connections, there's a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, it was a very, very challenging kind of concept. And now, you know, as of today's interview, it's been, you know, two years and a couple of months. And, you know, just recently, probably about 2 weeks ago, I ran into her at an event here in Los Angeles, even though she doesn't live here. So, you know, there's, you know, and healthy conversations can happen, you know, and some parts of that conversation were fantastic. Some parts of that conversation were not, you know, and that's life. And it's, you know, I think there does have to be a level of, you know, we congratulate people for getting in relationships. We should probably congratulate people for getting out of them. I remember telling my sister when I told my, well, one of my sisters, I have two of them, but when I told one of them about the breakup, her response was, you know, I'm glad you did it now, because had you waited until you got married, or even if there were kids were involved, she said, I don't even think I would speak to you again if I find out that you were breaking up a family. So I think, you know, as challenging as it was, it could have been way worse. Mm-hmm. And it could have been, and it could have been much better had I maybe done it earlier or anything, you know. And I think there's a learning journey from that as well. But I think that was important to include in the book, because the last thing I want people to view me as is some kind of love guru that has all the answers. And, you know, like, look how beautiful my life is, and buy my book and your life will be beautiful too. Like, no, these are reflections of somebody who gave up everything to really try to find out what love is. And here are my notes. And I'm still going through it the same way everybody else is. I just have my eyes a little bit wider. They're more open. And I'm trying to exist in a world of courage and not cynicism.
Yeah. Do you think that you will get married?
I'm not against the idea. I mean, there's nobody currently that I'm thinking about marrying, but, you know, it's interesting because, like, you know, I'm living in Los Angeles, and I'm even the building I'm living in are like, I live in lofts. They're giant one spaces, but they're big. But you realize how, like, these are not designed for two people. You know, if a friend comes over and they get a phone call, like, there's no room for them to go into. So I'm in a building full of, like, single people. And it's like you start to see, like, oh, like, there's a whole world of people that have no intention of doing any of this stuff. And they've kind of curated and cultivated a whole different life for themselves. So I think I'm open to kind of surrendering to where life takes me. You know, there's great arguments for getting married and having kids and creating kind of an intense purpose for your life that has no kind of refunds or exchanges at that point. And also, you know, there's a great argument for not doing it, knowing which way the world is headed. And, you know, I have that in the book with an ex-girlfriend who has children, saying that you know, she views having kids as a very selfish decision, and her encouraging me to be selfish and having kids, knowing, you know, where our environment is headed and where we're going as a population. So I think I'm kind of open to both. And I'm not the same level of energy I'm devoting to, like, Humble the Poet, the artist, and the journey and the entrepreneurial journey that I'm on. I'm not devoting that towards creating a partner or finding a partner or building a partnership. But I'm sure if I did, I'd probably be a lot more successful at it.
To look at our non-romantic relationships, how do you deepen those commitments and bring more love into your non-romantic relationships?
I think paying attention to the person in front of you, who they are. We all just want to be seen. You know, we all want to be seen and understood and accepted. And, you know, that requires much more work than just simply having empathy. So really, you know, out here, you know, you hear it a lot in LA, is, be the person who mentions your friends' names in a room, you know, when they're not there. And it's this idea of just think about people beyond yourself. And it's challenging in a world in a city full of ambitious people who are all just here defining themselves by their careers and just trying to make something happen. To me, which is just, you know, this is a city where people are in pursuit of the promise of unconditional love. You know, if I get famous enough, they will all love me. And, you know, they have massive chips on their shoulders and intense work ethics to pursue it. And they'll probably, you know, get very far, only to realize that it's not going to scratch the itch. So I think with people, it's really about seeing them, hearing them, you know, making their story a priority, letting them know that, you know, you exist for them. You're not just simply waiting for your turn to speak. And trying to read between the lines, that's been a really big thing for me, is realizing that everybody doesn't communicate the same. And I would love people to speak to me in a straight line, give it to me straight. That's not the case. And get better at that, picking up on the subtle cues and the nuances, you know. And I'm getting better at that. And I think that's allowing people to feel better about themselves around me. And I think that's what really matters. How do you make somebody feel like they actually matter? You know, especially in a world where there are so many distractions, letting somebody know they matter through your actions, through your words, and through the time that you invest in them.
Mm-hmm. And this gets back to your idea that love is really much more about an action than a feeling. I wonder, what do you think people can do to kind of shape their identity as a loving person and then to be living that out, taking those actions more in the world around them?
So I think service is the most important thing. You know, I think if you're on a spiritual journey, choose a spiritual template that involves service, heavy, heavy service. You know, I don't hear about service when I hear about yoga. I don't hear about service when I hear about your zodiacs. You know, all this modern spirituality, it's really sold to you from a self-absorbed perspective. Focus on people beyond yourself. You know, devote time towards other people. I recently heard about a friend of a friend who's a wealthy music executive. He devotes 6 months of his life to giving his lifestyle away. So when he's on a business flight, for example, he'll have a first class ticket and then he'll go back to economy and switch with somebody. You know, the things, the meals he was planning to buy. So his day-to-day life, he's got the money to do all this stuff. So he just takes his day-to-day life and he gives it to somebody else. So instead of he buys himself his lunch, gives it to somebody else. He does everything. And he does it. This is a 6 month thing for him, which I think is extremely brilliant. I think it's also it kind of lines up with some of the Stoic philosophies of denying yourself some of your luxuries to appreciate them. I don't know if he does 1 month, one month on, 1 month off, or if he just does a straight 6 months. But I think there's a beauty of that. It's just living outside of yourself for other people. Because nobody will get in your way when you want to help other people. You know, there'll be so many obstacles when you want to help yourself. There will be no obstacles when you want to help other people. So for me, I think service is important. You know, and you can still do the service selfishly. I actually work at a food bank in Culver City, and the selfishness of it is it's fun. The people are awesome. The environment is just high energy. And also, I don't have to think. Like, there's no thinking required while I'm there. There's somebody telling me, like, take this box of bread, open the box, put three pieces of bread in each bag. And it's like, this will be my task for the next 3 hours. And it's like, you know, as a writer, as an entrepreneur, as an employer, there's so many decisions I have to make to put myself in a situation where I'm doing this labor, I don't have to think, and immediately I can see the benefits of the labor. Like, I'm seeing the people who get this food. So I think there's a, you know, and that's okay. You know, that's okay if there's a selfish side to this service. The service is still important nonetheless. So looking for opportunities to serve, and it will also help to challenge our scarcity mindset that so many of us have been raised with, and realizing that, look, we are always in a position to serve and provide for other people. And we all have more than others, and we can do something about that. So I think service is so important. And I think physical service is important, you know, not just sharing a faux activism post on social media. You know, I think you have to get out there and be busy and do stuff and help people and use your tools, your skills, your muscles, your time, your energy to improve the life of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, Humble, before I get to a question from one of your fans, if people want to see how you're serving the world through your art and your music and your writing and everything, where should they look for you online?
You can find me at Humble the Poet on all social media, humblethepoet.com. And the new book is available at humblethepoet.com/love. As well as everywhere books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Indigo, Books A Million, Waterstones, wherever you are in the world, my book will be available.
Great. We'll put links to all that in the description for people to check out. And Humble, the final question from one of your fans, he'd like to know, what are the most helpful resources to expose yourself to new ideas?
People. I heard a really good quote, which was, whenever I want to meet God, I call an Uber and speak to my driver. And I think there's just a beautiful kind of concept in that, like, speak to your Uber drivers, you know, people, you know, there's a good commit to speak to three strangers a day about anything, you know. And I think it's bananas how there are so many people on this planet and how they all are having very unique experiences of this human form and unique perspectives, yet we all live very relatively in harmony. You know, it's not a perfect system, but for 8 billion people, it's very impressive that we're all existing. And we are seeing and hearing and tasting and experiencing the same things in very different ways. And you don't realize that. You know, I've realized, like, I have no idea what people think about when they see me. You know, I have no, it's all their story and their context. And instead of me projecting onto other people what they may be thinking about me, is to speak to people, hear from people. And it becomes super, super, super interesting. Yeah, get off the internet and talk to people.
Well, that is a beautiful and loving note to end on. Humble the Poet, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, man.
Thanks for watching this episode. To help get more great guests on the show, be sure to subscribe.